friends. Welcome to Wings Neighborhood. I'm your host, Varsha Vaishampayan, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Rupa Bhandarkar. Our guest today is Mary Jo Jacoby. It is my honor and privilege to welcome Mary Jo to our hood. Mary Jo brings wealth of professional experience ranging from being an assistant U.S. Secretary of Commerce to President George H.W. Bush, special assistant to President Ronald Reagan, member of the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments to UK's Prime Minister David Cameron and Theresa May, civil service commissioners to Queen Elizabeth II. She also played a pivotal role in managing the responses to three historic corporate crises as an executive in BP America, Royal Dutch Shell, and Drexel Burnham Lambert. Must I say more? I hope this gets your listening antennas all up. In this episode, Mary Jo talks about her journey from being a switchboard operator, making minimum wages, to being an internationally known and acclaimed crisis management expert. She believes in making her own luck. This discussion is filled with not one or two, but several golden nuggets. But what stood out for me is her practical advice to save money. She says financial security is foundational to your professional success. Without much further ado, I present to you Honorable Mary Jo Jacoby. Mary Jo, welcome to Wings Neighborhood. Thank you so much for taking the time and talking to us today. And as we were just mentioning, that we have so much to discuss with you that we may have to do part two. So I'm glad you said that will be okay.
That will be great.
All right. So what I'm going to start with, that Mary Jo, you had an amazing, interesting, and exciting career journey. You were in financial services, then global oil and gas. You were a special assistant to President Ronald Reagan, assistant U.S. Commerce Secretary for President George H.W. Bush, and a British civil service commissioner. My God, look at this. Cross industry, cross geographies. And if I must say, at that time when you did all of this, there were not too many women doing this. My questions start with that. How do you do this? How do you plan all of this? Do you plan? You don't. You find opportunities, or opportunities find you?
I didn't plan. I did find opportunities, and mostly opportunities found me. So, and I think if I had had a plan, you know, when I was young and starting out, advisors always said, oh, you know, you have to have a career life plan. If I had had a plan, I don't think that I would have done the things that I did, because they wouldn't have fit with the plan. For example, when after I got my MBA and I left working on Capitol Hill and became a lobbyist for 3M Company, I was on an excellent career trajectory with them. I was the youngest person in the company to be promoted to manager, which was a big title for a very big company in those days. And if I had had a plan, I would have stayed at 3M, but instead the opportunity presented itself for me to go into the Reagan administration, initially with the Secretary of Commerce and then at the White House. I was recommended for this role by the chairman of 3M. I made my own luck by doing a really good job and working really hard, but if I had had a career plan, I would have stayed with 3M, and I probably would have stayed with 3M for my whole career. And all of these other things wouldn't have happened.
One of the most important things, Mary Jo, if you can talk about, that how did you find these opportunities? As you say, the opportunities really came to you. But if women want to have this kind of career, what's your advice? How do they make themselves visible in the marketplace?
You have to be open. You have to put yourself in circumstances where people will notice you, particularly right now during this COVID. That's not easy because everything is virtual, but you show up in the chat room, you attend virtual events, you ask questions, you get seen. And there's a risk in that because you risk sounding silly or uninformed or possibly even arrogant, but it's important for you to be present. And it's awfully difficult sometimes to force yourself to get dressed, to put on that game face, but it is really, really important. Don't turn down an opportunity when you're invited. Even if you think you're not right, do it anyway and put yourself out there. It does work. And of course, there is risk because not everyone will like you and not everyone will appreciate what you're doing. But you're not out to impress them. You're out to advance your own career and to give yourself joy. And that's important.
I think all that goes into what you say, Mary Jo, is, you know, making your own luck, right?
That's what Mrs. Thatcher said. It's preparation coinciding with opportunity. And that's how you make your own luck. But if you stay home looking at the internet all the time, wearing your bedroom slippers, you will probably not have those opportunities. You just have to put yourself out there and meet people and engage with them and be curious. I think probably one of the greatest gifts that my parents ever gave me was curiosity, to want to know about other people, to want to know about things that I don't already know. And that curiosity has always served me well.
Wonderful, wonderful. I think that's a great segue into the question I wanted to ask you. You know, we seem to be noticing a trend here across our guests. A number of them share that, you know, their mothers or grandmothers inspired them to be the person that they are. And as we briefly talked, Mary Jo, you know, found some similarity between your background and mine. My dad used to own a bakery as well. And my mom was used to work at a bank. And my maternal grandmother was my BFF. She was my first and forever BFF, source of inspiration for me. And you'd mentioned your parents and especially your grandmother had a huge influence on you. So tell us a little bit more about them and how they shaped you to be the person you are.
Well, like you, I grew up in a bakery and my father baked the products and my mother sold them and we lived on top. There were five of us. I'm the youngest of five. My parents worked very, very hard. The greatest lesson that they gave us was supply and demand economics, because we knew if we came home from school in the afternoon and there were a lot of bakery products left, it wasn't going to be a happy evening. And we knew if we came home and all the bread was gone, that was a good day. So it was a tangible way of learning economics. Also, they taught us the value of working hard. They worked incredibly hard. They both worked 12-hour days, but not the same 12 hours. My father worked midnight to noon. My mother worked 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. But the fortunate thing for my brother and sisters and me was that they were always there. They didn't go off someplace and come back at the end of 2 weeks with money. We physically understood the process of making it, the process of selling it. And they were always present for us when we were growing up, which was a tremendous gift and a tremendous opportunity. So they instilled in us the value of hard work. They instilled in us the concept of self-belief, that if we worked hard, we could achieve things. And most importantly, for my three sisters and me, they never told us because we were girls, we couldn't do something. They encouraged us to do whatever we wanted to try, as long as it was legal. And so it was a great way to grow up. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, lived next door to us. And she was a confidant and a friend, as grandmothers can be that mothers can't quite be. The great gift of the grandmother. And she taught me to have a sense of humor and not to take myself too seriously. And that was a very important lesson because, you know, there are plenty of things to be serious about, but sometimes you just have to sit back and have a good time and a good laugh.
That is wonderful. As you progressed in your career, I'm sure your dad must have been very proud of you. And any reflections on what he shared in terms of, you know, as he saw you grow and succeed?
He was a tremendous force in my life, particularly after my mother passed away. He was 80 when she passed, but he taught me not to be selfish or to try not to be selfish. And he gave me freedom. And they both encouraged us to be free and to leave home and go and make our way in the world. And I will never forget the day she passed away. I received the offer I had been waiting for from HSBC in London to go to work in London. And then that evening, it was a Saturday, and that evening I got word that my mother had died. So I immediately went home to be with my siblings and with my father. And I stayed on for several days after my mother's funeral to be with my father and to help him adjust, I guess, to living alone. I was single at the time and had never married yet. So I knew how to be single and he didn't. They had been married for more than 50 years. And I will never forget, I said nothing about the offer. And my father, the day before I was scheduled to go back to New York, said, So what happened with this big job that you were talking about? And I said, well, as it turns out, the contract came on Saturday. And he said, well, what did you do about it? I said, well, nothing. I got on a plane and came home. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, you know, Dad, I don't know. Things have changed now with Mama having gone. And he said, I hope you're not thinking of not taking this job, of not doing something you've always wanted to do because of me. That's not the way we raised you. If this is something you want, you must go. I feel so blessed to have had parents who were willing to let their children fly, because so many parents, particularly when they get into advanced years, cling very hard to their children. They raised us to be free, and it was a great gift. And although I don't have children, I do have two stepdaughters, and I always encourage them to fly.
I remember, Mary Jo, that you had mentioned this to me, that when Drexel Burnham went down, your father didn't know about this, and one of your siblings told him, and he said that he is very proud to have raised a daughter who can lose so much money.
Yes, I did lose a great deal of money.
What an
heavily
insight.
Invested in the firm, and like a lot of my colleagues, we all lost a great deal of money. But I made it back. And, you know, but my father did say, you know, it makes me proud to have raised a child who could lose that much money.
So, you know, continuing on to that journey of yours, which now you are a crisis management expert, and you have to be a strong leader to deal with crisis anywhere. And you mentioned once that you make your own luck. And for that, you do have to be at the right place at the right time. But for some people, that might be the wrong place at the wrong time. People will run away when they see crisis. That wasn't you.
No, I ran into the fire. And I was always willing to work whatever hours were necessary, whatever days were necessary. And when I was with Drexel and we were working on the securities fraud investigation, we had a conference call on Christmas Day. That's how busy it was, but it was what was necessary. I have always been interested in taking on roles that would stretch me, roles that would teach me new things or create an environment where I could learn new things and not to shrink from a challenge. I've always volunteered for things. And I think a big difference between men and women, certainly in my generation, men don't hesitate to step up, you know, to an opportunity. And they don't sit around thinking, ooh, I wonder if I'm really qualified. I wonder if I know how to do this. Maybe it won't work out. They just do it and it works out, or it doesn't. And then they do something else. But women have a greater tendency to want to weigh all of the issues and question their own qualifications and their own capabilities and all of the reasons not to do something. I have always been willing to just say, okay, yeah, I can do that, and then figure out how to do it once I'm in the role. It has served me well. It isn't to everybody's taste because it's hard. But if you don't work hard, you don't get big rewards. And I have been very fortunate in my rewards.
You said, right, that failures are your part of your success journey. Right?
Sure.
You have to fail, and recovering gracefully from those failures is the key to your success. How do you actually, in a practical sense, how do you do that?
You learn how to fail at a young age. For example, I was never good at sports when I was growing up, but my mother was very interested in her children participating. So we had to try out, all of us, for all of the sports teams. And I was not good at it. And I never made the team, but I always tried. So I learned disappointment. And I think we cannot raise children in a world where they're wrapped in cotton fluff to protect them from the knocks of the outside world. You have to learn that it doesn't always go your way. You won't always be successful. Things can be very unpleasant. And the earlier you learn how to fail and accept it and get up and move on, the failure isn't the problem. It is the unwillingness to try anymore that is the problem. And Winston Churchill, I don't know the exact quote, but he has a great quote about that. You just have to get back up and try again and try something else. That didn't work, so let's try this. And if you aren't willing to try, if you aren't willing to take those chances, to take those risks, you'll have a very safe life, but you won't be very happy.
Does passion play a role in being Very resilient.
You know, they say today, do what you're passionate about. I say, do what you're interested in and you can develop the passion. I can't say I had a burning desire to become a crisis manager, but I became one because it was a logical progression of the jobs that I held and the things that I did. And it turns out I'm very good at it. So it has been a very rewarding career, both emotionally and financially. But sometimes if you're pursuing your passion, there may not be jobs that you're passionate about. Then you have to take a step back, think about what's really important to you, possibly repackage yourself for a new world, learn new skills, and move on.
We are going through a national crisis now. You know, pandemic has changed a lot of things for a lot of people, and especially for women, and especially for working mothers, right? So we all have to retain what we are so good at it. Don't let our problems get ahead of ourselves. But I want to go a little bit in the corporate setup and ask this question that we hear many times our mentees say, that, but I don't have authority to make decisions, right? I want to, I know how to, but nobody's asking me. What do you say to that?
Don't wait to be asked. Step up, volunteer, raise your hand. If there's an opportunity to do something that you think you can do, raise your hand and offer to be on the team, offer to lead the team. Let your bosses know that you're interested and that you're willing to learn new things, to take new chances, step up to that big assignment, and then learn how to do it. And then what you've done is contributed to the success of the organization, but also expanded your own skill set. So I was not a crisis manager by training. I learned it on the job. Then after Drexel Burnham went bankrupt, I had a new skill, crisis management. I found an employer who needed that skill, HSBC in New York, and I packaged myself for that role. One of the things that I think we all have to learn to be better at is identifying the things that A, we're good at, and B, that we like to do, and then packaging them up in a way that it is something that an employer will consider. They're not going to figure it out unless you show it to them. It's sales 101. I didn't know I needed this product until it was presented to me. So we have to look at the things we've done and package those things in a way that they add value to an employer.
You've constantly been in these high-stress situations, yet you appear calm, collected. How has all of this affected you as a person? Because many times I think women, in addition to some of those things that you mentioned early on, you know, men don't question things, they take on that next opportunity. But women sometimes wonder, is this going to be too high stress? Can I manage that in a number of different ways? So how has being in this high stress situation constantly affected you as a person, and how have you grown from it?
Well, it's helped me understand what's important to me. I have rightly or wrongly put my work first ahead of my personal life for most of my life. I wasn't married until I was 53, which is a rather mature bride. But again, going back to the way I was raised, you know, the business came first. And if you talk to my siblings, they would say the same thing. You know, the business comes first and the business is the key to everything else. And so that's how I've pursued my career, so that I could have a good life and my husband and I can now have a good third life for the both of us. Looking back at time, I was perhaps too driven, perhaps a bit too ruthless, perhaps a bit too impatient. I can't change those things. I can learn from them and not do those things again. And that's what's important, because you can't undo the past. It's done. But what can I do better the next time? I never hesitated to walk into that fire. I never hesitated to repackage and reinvent myself as the need came by. But I have always had a strong sense of, I guess, resilience, that I will get through this. Margaret Thatcher, this is one of my favorite Margaret Thatcher quotes. I have a couple of them. A great problem of our age, now this is going back quite a number of years, a great problem of our age is that we're governed by people who care more about feelings than about ideas. And if you care too much about feelings, you will always have hurt feelings. You can't wear your feelings on your sleeves. You have to just get out there, You have to be interested. You have to be curious. You have to put yourself on a team and worry about the objectives of the team, the ideas of the team, and get past your hurt feelings. And bear in mind that every team has to have a leader. Be that leader.
That's amazing.
Let me follow up on that, Mary Jo. These days, you know, a lot has been said about women are more empathetic and men need to be more empathetic and it's okay to show your emotionals. What are your thoughts? I think you just kind of mentioned it, but I wanted to hear it specifically again in this context.
It's not okay to show your emotions all the time. It's good to show genuine emotions in the appropriate moment. One of my great shortcomings is that I'm a bit too outspoken and I don't hesitate to often speak before I've fully thought it through. And that's not a good way to be in most circumstances. But we don't have the luxury of having emotional outbursts at work. We don't have the luxury of being angry, of being upset, of having hurt feelings visibly. There are moments when it's justified to be angry and to show that anger. There are moments when it's justified to be euphoric and to show that euphoria. But those moments tend to have to do with the objectives of the project that you're working on rather than your own feelings. Yes, there have been times when I've gone to the ladies' room and gotten in the stall and cried my eyes out. And then I put myself back together and went back to my desk. People don't want to hear about it. You cannot always be feeling. You have to be thinking. You have to be clear-headed. You have to put the emotion to one side for the good of the team, for the good of the project, for the good of achieving the objective.
You're listening to the Showing Up as a Leader podcast hosted by Wings for Growth. If you're ready to take the leap and build your wings on your way up, sign up for our leadership development program at www.wingsforgrowth.org. We've talked a lot about a lot of serious stuff, emotions, passions, everything. Maybe we just break a little bit and do some fun stuff, Mary Jo. With all of our guest speakers, we do rapid fire. Are you up for that?
I'm ready.
Okay. And like I said, it says rapid fire, but there's nothing rapid about it. You can take the time. All right. So here comes the first question. Your favorite book?
Advise and Consent. It's a book that came out in 1959. The author was Alan Drury. It's a political novel. He did a trilogy of political novels. And it is about a presidential nominee for the office of Secretary of State. And it is a book that stimulated my interest in national politics when I was quite young. It gave me the ambition of someday being appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, which is what advice and consent is. Will the Senate give its advice and consent to the nomination of? And so in 1992, I achieved that ambition, and the Senate gave its advice and consent to the nomination of Mary Jo Jacoby to be Assistant Secretary of Commerce of the United States.
Awesome accomplishments. Okay, your favorite leader?
My favorite leader? It's a tie between Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher.
Mm.
And they were very good friends. I was blessed to have worked for President Reagan, and I was blessed to have met Mrs. Thatcher on a couple of occasions, not while I was working for the president. Both great leaders, both clear visionaries. You may not agree with the vision, but you can certainly understand that they had directions in mind that they thought their country should go. I think President Reagan was perhaps a bit softer-hearted than Mrs. Thatcher, but both very good, driven, clear visionaries.
Your favorite TV show?
That's quite easy. There is a British television show called Gogglebox. It doesn't come on in America, and it is people being filmed watching television. And I would love to have been in the pitch meeting when someone came up with this idea and sold it. They also have it in Australia now. And it is very funny and also very topical. And I think leaders can learn a lot from it, from the way the viewers react in real time.
Well, maybe now we should consider getting that TV show here. All right. Your favorite vacation spot, Mary?
At home.
Oh, yeah.
At home. I've always been in situations where I traveled a great deal. Until the COVID virus, I traveled at least once a month internationally. And I haven't been on an airplane since February of last year, February of 2020. I thought it would be hard staying home, and I actually love it. And now I'm going to find it hard traveling again. It's been like a year-long vacation for me.
I think this is going to be one of the unique ones. All right, your favorite drink?
Blueberry vodka.
Anything blueberry but vodka.
There is a French sparkling wine called Cremant, which I really like. It's lighter than champagne, not as full-bodied as champagne, and not as bubbly. And I quite like that. And of course, water, because you have to say water.
All right, next one is your favorite color.
Green.
Do you have a preference between white and black?
No.
No. You don't like both of them?
Well, they're not colors.
Okay, that works too.
I once told a boss of mine, the chairman of HSBC, we were redecorating his office, and he was picking out fabrics for his sofas, and he asked me what I thought of them, and they were not to my taste. And he said, so what is your favorite color? And I said, beige. And he went crazy. He said, beige, nobody's favorite color is beige. And of course, it wasn't my favorite color, but it was a provocative comment. Green is my favorite color. I have no preference between white and black. I wear a lot of black because it's slimming.
I think we all agree with that part for ourselves too.
And both I was white wondering, and black go with everything else, which makes it easy. But so does
right,
beige.
Right. And I was wondering, Mary Jo, does green have anything to do with your crisis management background, you know, going away from red to green?
No, green has to do with the color of my eyes.
Yeah. Oh, very nice.
And my eyes are green, and when I wear green, they become more green.
Your favorite leadership quote?
Got to be Margaret Thatcher, which is, don't follow the crowd, let the crowd follow you. Great leadership quote.
Yep, it is a very good leadership quote. Okay, that's the end of rapid fire. You did yes. really well, but we have no prize for you. Sorry. All right, Rupa, should I just go for my next question?
Yes, please, Varsha.
So I remember, Mary Jo, that we had conversations about mentors, and you said that you have had mentors in your life and career. You said you had a mentor from, 1973? And
yes.
She's still a good friend and a good mentor.
Yes.
And as you know, that Wings for Growth is a women's leadership development program through mentoring and coaching. That little commercial plug there. What does it take for someone to be a great mentor? And how do you mentor someone?
Well, based on my experience of having mentors, a great mentor is a sounding board. They don't tell you what to do, but they help you think of situations in a different way that you might not have considered. Ultimately, that helps you figure out what you should do. And they also do give advice. A good mentor, everybody loves to give advice. You don't have to take the advice, but everybody loves to give it. I think a good mentor is a good sounding board. They listen. They often will tell you back what they've heard you say, which helps you make decisions and helps you formulate your approach to an issue or a problem. But mostly they listen. And they act interested, even if they aren't. and that's how I've tried to be, not acting interested. I try to be interested. And I try to look at my mentees' challenges, not through my own lens necessarily of what I've experienced and what I've done or what I would do, but in getting to know them, how I think they might best go about addressing an issue that the approach is true to them as opposed to true to me.
I had a question, Mary Jo. You know, you already gave very valuable and practical advice to women as they're considering navigating their careers. Specifically, you've been very successful from a very young age. You've been probably the youngest in some of your roles and the only woman at the leadership table. And all of this, you know, as you were coming up through the ranks, there were D&I programs. But now, you know, the spotlight is on all of this. There is so much companies are investing. There is a lot of effort around this. What's your advice to companies as they try to, you know, bring in more equity and have all these structured programs? So advice to companies and to the women participating in this.
I think the companies really need to be open to true diversity. Yes, gender diversity is very important. Racial and ethnic diversity are also very important. But a truly diverse workforce is one that has diversity of thought, that has diversity of perspective, that brings in a different way of thinking. And you can often do this simply by expanding gender diversity and by expanding racial and ethnic diversity. But we don't want a workforce of everybody who thinks the same way. And even women, for example, women engineers, can often think the same way that men engineers think. I think to grow, companies need that different perspective, that different thought, that it can come from gender or it can come from race, but it has to be cultivated. And companies have to create an environment that welcomes those differences. And I don't like the expression creates a safe space, because no space is truly safe. You make your own safe space, and that's in your mind. But that creates an environment where people can feel like they can speak out, feel like they can be different, and it won't be punished.
It can't be a check-the-box exercise.
No.
It just has to be a mindset culture change where they embrace all kinds of diversity.
That being said, though, it does have to come from the top, because it won't develop organically unless somebody pushes the change.
The tone has to be set from the top.
The tone comes from the top.
There's no denying that men, especially in corporates and business environment, they're more privileged than women are. Women don't have enough role models. So something has to be said about growth, development, and sponsorship from the top for women to rise.
Well, I've had women mentors and I've had men mentors. And my first, in fact, it was a man mentor who introduced me to the woman mentor who has been my friend for far too many years, since 1973. Men can be role models too. I don't agree with the expression, if I can't see it, I can't be it. I am proof that you don't have to see it to be it, because it wasn't around when I started out. Most of my roles, there were very few, if any, women besides me. So I don't think that's necessary. Men aren't the enemy. Men can be very valuable allies, very important allies, and very good friends as well. And if you're in an environment where it's mostly men, you don't have much choice. You know, if you want to grow and prosper, you will need those men as allies. I don't think you have to have a woman as a mentor, but it helps. And I don't think you have to see it to be it.
Do you feel like there are unintended consequences right now where men may be feeling alienated with the focus that's there that may seem unnatural at times? Any thoughts on that?
Yes. And I think that we can sometimes be unforgiving of men and the situation that men sometimes find themselves in. They don't know how to react either, because they've never had women in the room. I am not making any excuses for misbehavior, but I am making a plea that we be a bit more accepting of the change that they're going through as well. It's different for us. It's different for them. Let's all work together to make it better for everybody. And it is hard because it's different. You have other things that are hard too. You have the baby boomer, which I am, versus the millennial versus Generation Z, and they're all very different. And then you have Generation X in the middle, and those poor people get left out of everything. They're the middle management folks. And of course, my generation, the boomers, are retiring. 10,000 a day in the United States are retiring. So we're working our way out. But it is a challenge to manage the different expectations, the different demands, if you will, when you have a workforce comprised of three or four generations and you're at the top, because the expectations are different. The way you as a manager manage those individuals is different. Baby boomers are much more likely to just want to get on with it and be motivated by money. Generation X, I haven't figured out yet. Millennials are much more motivated by feelings, and Generation Z is actually, in many respects, more like baby boomers than they are like millennials. But a manager, a leader, has to be able to flex their style to deal with the expectations of those different groups in an organization.
I'm letting that sink in a little bit. And you know what, Mary Jo, you have been ahead of us. Every time you ask the question or you want to, you already responded. So good news is we actually did it in time.
Yay!
So I have one last question before we call it done. And we ask that question to all our guest speakers. In 2021 will be an interesting year. What's your advice to women leaders who are ready to take the leap and build their wings on the way?
Don't be afraid. And even if you are afraid, hide it from everyone else, including yourself. Socrates has a very good quote about reputation. And the way to have a good reputation is to be what you desire to appear. And so, especially for people just starting out in their career, be that person who is where you want to be next. Think one step ahead. Don't be afraid. Don't think of yourself as a victim. Put a time limit on how long you're going to allow yourself to feel bad about a setback, and then move on. And then the other advice I would give is to save money, even if it's just a little bit every month. And it's not easy when you don't make a lot and you have a lot of responsibilities to save. But it's very, very important to put away even a small nest egg to help give you confidence, so that if something terrible happens, you have a resource beneath you to help get you through, to help you draw on your skills, but to give you a little bit of a cushion financially. It's hard to do. It's hard to save. Actually, one latte a week, you'd be surprised how quickly it mounts up.
I love that. I think that's going to be the quote card for this episode. Reduce one, take one less latte.
One less latte a week.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You don't hear this kind of advice very often, right? When women think about leadership, workforce, managing work and life balance. But this is so practical that we often don't say it enough to the next generation, to millennials. So,
well, you know, we have to be practical, because if we're not, no one else will be. You need that little bit of an edge to help protect you, even if it's only protecting you emotionally. I will close with one last story. When I was in university, I worked my way through as a switchboard operator. This is one of those jobs that no longer exists at the university. So I answered the university's main telephones and put the calls through to the dean's office or the president's office. And it was a work study thing, and I worked off tuition. And it was frankly the only way I could get through college, was working part time. Anyway, when I was working on Capitol Hill, there was a leadership change after an election, and my boss retired and was gone. And the new chairman of the new ranking member of the committee wanted his own person, and I was let go. So all of a sudden, here I am with not much savings, no job to go to, and no job. And what did I do? I became a part-time switchboard operator to give me money so that I could eat and put petrol in my car and look for another more permanent job. So never let go of an old skill. I started life as a secretary. I learned shorthand. I still take shorthand in my meetings. And I remember once, a long time ago, a colleague said, "Oh, don't let anybody see you taking shorthand. That will demean your position." And I said, "Well, you know, not to anybody that matters will it demean my position, but I will have an accurate record of this meeting and no one else will." So don't let go of your old skills. You never know when you need to draw on them.
Such amazing advice, Mary Jo, both what you mentioned about the skills and the kind of financial security, the confidence that comes out of that little bit of financial security that you have to make that next bold move that you may otherwise, you know, prevent yourself from doing.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just thinking that if my father was listening to this, he would have said exactly these kind of things. He always said that to us, right? Financial security is important. Don't worry about whatever job you need to do, doesn't matter. It's not the ego, right? It's getting it done and moving it forward. I don't want to even talk about it anything anymore. This is a very amazing end to this episode. We really thank you, Mary Jo. I know that we got all our questions, but somewhere I feel like we're going to be more greedy and we'll probably still come back to one more interview if that's possible.
I'm always available. I want to help your members grow their wings. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. We wish you the best as you take the learnings from this podcast and strive to show up as a leader in all those moments, situations, and interactions where you can make a difference. Build your wings and sign up to be part of the Wings program at www.wingsforgrowth.org.